These are the oldest stories. Online at oldeststories.net. We've seen three kings of Assyria set the template for the greatest empire of the Iron Age. Ashur-dan, Adad-nirari, and Tukulti-Ninurta have all done a great job of conquering neighbors and slaughtering enemies and bringing in new populations and plundering wealth and constructing districts and infrastructure and keeping the great god happy all at the same time. They are, as they say, empire building. They knew exactly what they wanted to accomplish, and they knew how to accomplish it. Indeed, if you were a time traveler, and also a psychopath who wanted to build your own ancient empire, you could hardly do a better job than the Assyrian kings were managing up to this point. If you were to take these three kings and just drop them into most other historical periods and give them the same level of success, they alone would be enough to found one of the world historic dynasties. And yet, all three are, in the case of Assyria, merely a prelude for what's to come. Now that the dusty dregs of the Dark Age are all thoroughly shaken off, now that Assyria stands once again upon a solid foundation with a veritable avalanche of tribute, taxation, and plunder feeding the treasury, Tukulti-Ninurta dies in 884 BCE with a smile on his face, knowing that he was king over a great empire. His son, Ashur-nasir-apli II, whose name means Ashur guards my heir, and who's usually known by the Hebrewization of his name, Ashur-nasir-pal, ascended the throne after him with a scowl. For Ashur-nasir-pal knew that the petty kingdom of his father could be a far greater entity. The key to his success, he reasoned, was psychopathy. If he set himself up as the most vile, evil, cruel monster the world had ever known, then probably everything would go really, really well for him, and his empire would grow without limit and stand forever. And as it turned out, he was kind of right. The Assyrian kings have known the value of cruelty since at least the Middle Assyrian period. Even the seemingly cheerful Tukulti-Ninurta, who'd kind of just wanted to explore and camp and hang out with other people. I mean, he traded heavily on the reputation that his people had already built up to grow the empire. And of course, he added to it by slaughtering all those who opposed him on those cheerful, friendly camping trips. There's a paradox here in some instances where a person, group, or empire is able to take what they want with less violence sometimes, because the people on the receiving end know that the Assyrians are capable of such great violence. In the pirate era of the 1600s AD, many pirates deliberately cultivated fearsome reputations because a ship which couldn't flee would often surrender without fighting, which saved the pirate groups from the expense of losing crewmates and risking damage to the ship. Indeed, if every merchant ship in the great pirate era had attempted resistance, then the cost of piracy would have risen proportionately higher. And though things would have gone far worse for the resisting ships, the number of successful pirates would likely have been much lower, as the cost of piracy would have been much higher. Similarly, the cost of empire is much lower for the Assyrians than it would otherwise be, since many places simply fall into their lap out of sheer terror, saving the kings the cost of actually conquering and subduing these lands by force. The economic and efficiency value of terror is going to be a defining feature of the empire for its entire history. However, perhaps an occupational hazard of building your empire around terror is that every now and then you're going to get a guy who is way more creative at generating terror than a fully sane person might be. And this is Ashur-nasir-pal. He's going to be a great king, even among the ranks of great kings that we're going to see in Assyrian history. But through it all, we're going to see that his greatness was rather more grim for a great many people than the greatness of many other kings. He won't be the only sadistic Assyrian king, but he is notable for some of his deeds. And as an added bonus in all of this, we get more from Ashurnasirpal in terms of sources and details than I think we've had possibly for anyone in Mesopotamian history up to this point. I mean, the period around Hammurabi has quite a lot, but not nearly as much from the king himself. In the royal inscriptions of Mesopotamia for this era, which is the set of books I use a lot for this history in particular, the book on the early first millennium runs from 1114 to 859 BCE. And Ashurnasirpal alone is a few pages over half of the entire book, which ends, of course, at the end of his reign. Of course, we have later kings who occupy whole volumes by themselves, and when we get to Sargon II, he's going to fill two volumes just of his inscriptions, with his auguries, letters, and economic texts, each relegated to separate volumes. So there's a lot more to look forward to when we get to the Sargonids. But Ashurnasirpal is, for the historian, where the Neo-Assyrian information overload really begins. Now, the overload begins with his titulary. Now, Assyrian kings have always had grandiose titles. Indeed, most kings in most places puff themselves up with a superfluidity of verbiage, as they might say. But Ashurnasirpal takes it to a whole new level. Now, I cut each king a lot of slack, assuming that in these official documents, they're puffing themselves up to a degree that, you know, maybe they don't necessarily believe it, they just have to do it to keep up appearances. But the excess for Ashurnasirpal is so excessive that I wonder the extent to which he truly was a genuine narcissist. Now, he is the first king in a long time to have a standard inscription that we're aware of, a single text which is copied with extremely few variations on everything he builds. And because the amount of evidence we have from his reign, I mean, with all of that, we have over 400 surviving copies of this standard inscription, making it the most copied thing that we have recovered up to this point in history. This standard inscription abbreviates his full listing of titles compared to what we get in the fuller accounts. I read a much fuller accounting of his titles over on TikTok, where it took me 4 minutes just to get through all of them. But the abbreviated standard list reads something like this. Ashurnasirpal, vice-regent of Ashur, chosen of the gods Enlil-nirta, beloved of the gods An and Dagon, destructive weapon of the great gods, strong king, king of the universe, king of Assyria, son of Tukulti-Ninurta, great king, strong king, king of the universe, king of Assyria, son of Adad-nirari, who was also great king, strong king, king of the universe, king of Assyria, valiant man who acts with the support of Ashur his lord, and has no rival among the princes of the four quarters, marvelous shepherd, fearless in battle, mighty flood tide which has no opponent, the king who subdues those insubordinate to him, he who rules all peoples, strong male who treads upon the necks of his foes, trampler of all enemies, he who breaks up the forces of the rebellious, the king who acts with the support of the great gods, his lords, and has conquered all lands, gained dominion over all the highlands, who has received their tribute, capturer of hostages, he who is victorious over all countries, Ashurnasirpal, attentive prince, worshipper of the great gods, ferocious dragon, conqueror of cities and the entire highlands, king of lords, encircler of the obstinate, crowned with splendor, fearless in battle, merciless hero, he who stirs up strife, praiseworthy king, shepherd, protection of the four quarters, the king whose command disintegrates mountains, mountains and seas, the one who by his lordly conflict has brought under one authority ferocious and merciless kings from east to west. And that's the abbreviated version. There are fuller versions which go on significantly longer. Those who know the character Setra the Imperishable will find that Setra's fictional titulary, which is a parody of the grandiose claims of ancient kings like this, is in many cases actually quite humble compared to what's claimed by Ashurnasirpal. But it isn't just the names. The deeds of Ashurnasirpal are described in over-the-top terms, but at the same time with an unprecedented level of detail. Because of that, we can really dig into some of the years of his reign, and it's a good thing that I've previously mentioned all the caveats involved with reading through royal annals. You know, they're not always totally reliable, since many of them have those same tendencies towards exaggeration and whitewashing, which are visible in Ashurnasirpal's records. However, I'm going to spend less time pausing to notice the issues here, since we'll probably never make it through all the material if we both analyze and meta-analyze everything. Just keep a handful of skeptical thoughts in the back of your head while we read through here. Now, we don't know in what month Tukulti-Ninurta died, which is pretty typical, but it's actually quite relevant here, since Ashurnasirpal hops right up and gets going seemingly the moment his father dies. Ashurnasirpal was possibly born in 910 BCE, and it's now 883, which means he's somewhere around 33 years old. He's probably already spent much of his early life out on campaign, either with his father or with independent troops, but we hear nothing of any of that, as is typical for Assyrian heirs. It seems likely that he was currently in charge of the army when his father dies, or perhaps already getting it ready for the next year's campaign, as there's no break at all. He takes the crown and immediately heads east into the Iranian mountains to expand the empire and just to plunder. This is the land of Tumu, rich in metals and horses, as well as other livestock. He immediately storms the fortified town of Libay, then takes an array of subordinate towns which had been defended and were no longer defended by the fort at Libay. He slaughtered or enslaved all that he could catch, filled his wagons with plunder, and then, if you can believe it, discovered to his dismay that all the people in the region had fled into the most inaccessible mountains they could find. Now, why would they do that? I know why they would have done it. It's because they're going to get slaughtered. And sure enough, that's what happened next. The mountain in question, where they've all fled, is not even named. We're told only that it was exceptionally rugged, straight and sharp like a dagger, and so high and worthless as to be inhospitable even to the birds. Now, at the top of this miserable rock was a fort set up like a bird's nest, which no Assyrian king had ever managed to assault before. And so Ashurnasirpal would have us believe that he personally went ahead of the army and spent 3 days climbing around the mountain, exploring its paths and secrets, and then personally reaching the fortress upon the summit, where he proceeded to just Assassin's Creed the entire fortress, slaughtering 200 enemy guards with his sword, allowing his army to enter in behind him, and with seemingly little resistance, simply carry away all the people as captives. He then did the typical thing of dyeing the entire mountain red with their blood, creating a torrential river of blood to flow down the mountain as if it were a new stream, and then he went around the region and destroyed a bunch of now defenseless cities. With this example announced to the region, he then moved to the next area, the eastern lands around Kiraru, where the cities decided to just skip the whole war part and get right to the offering up of plunder. Ashurnasirpal Paul carted off large amounts of work animals, horses, mules, and oxen, which were themselves a prize, but also quite useful in carrying away all the other prizes he's won, wine, bronze, silver, gold, tin, and ornate worship objects are all mentioned. But most useful for the new king is that he imposes upon these people corvée labor requirements, and sends the first huge batch of workers back home along with a string of captives to start the project which he's already envisioning to be his crowning achievement. Now we'll cover that more fully in the next episode, but the city of Kalhu, which will be the new capital of the Assyrian Empire in just a few years, is already under construction here in the very first year of Ashurnasirpal's reign. Moving along the Iranian mountains, a new set of towns resists him. This set of towns is probably one more kingdom, but Assyrian chronicles very frequently represent enemy kingdoms as just a series of towns or tribes to make the conquest seem larger and to make the unity and therefore legitimacy of the enemy seem less. This would help them seem not like a legitimate political force when compared to the mighty, unitary Assyrian Empire. There is the regular set of plunderings and slaughterings, and then again we see the enemy retreats to the mountain fortress town of Nishtun, which was as high as the clouds, or so we're told. Still, Ashurnasirpal is starting to really get the hang of how to assault mountain fortresses which would be otherwise impenetrable. And this time he doesn't claim to have taken it alone, not that we really credit him being wholly alone in the previous account, but he does say that he took a picked company of warriors along with him, who flew like birds. And this small group was able to infiltrate and open up the fortress, killing 260 men in the process and opening up the gates for the army. Now we have to ask here, did Ashurnasirpal actually heroically act either on his own or leading a small group? Or is he just taking credit for someone else's bravery? And the truth here is really unknowable. It isn't impossible that he, having lived in and around the army his whole life and having been groomed for martial prowess, I mean, he may have been at least a competent warrior, and quite possibly an exceptional one in a genuine sense. He would have had every advantage available at that ancient time. In addition, his seemingly profound narcissism, plus the expectations laid upon him as a king, may have driven him to seek out these sorts of military exploits. Plus, I would say that he seems to be an actual psychopath, which always helps with the whole seeking out acts of violence thing. On the other hand, it is very easy to lie in official propaganda, and extremely common for kings to take personal credit for things that they merely ordered to happen and did not actually carry out. Of course, we see this most clearly in construction projects, where we typically doubt heavily that the king himself did a whole lot of digging and bricklaying after the ceremonial foundation setting. There is a real case to be made in either direction here, though, and I personally do kind of like imagining that Ashurnasirpal will be the next Assassin's Creed hero, so we're going to keep telling the story as if he were a hero, keeping in mind that it may all be narcissistic propaganda, equivalent to the modern North Korean leaders claiming to have played perfect games of golf and invented the helicopter or whatever else they claim to do. Anyway, the fortress now breached and the army at the gates, the mountain folk are defeated. A round of pillaging, plundering, and destruction occurs, followed by tribute, tax, and corvée labor. Possibly also a deportation, we're not totally sure in this case. The king of that town in Nishtun, high in the mountains, gets brought back in triumph to Arba'il, then publicly flayed and his skin is draped over the city wall like a flag. Arba'il is located on the Great Zab River, a Tigris tributary, and following the victory, Ashurnasirpal, for some reason, travels to a spring, which is one of the river's headwaters, and he either founds or renames a town at the spring after himself, and builds a large monument to himself for the glory of himself, or the god Ashur, one of the two. But the year is not over. All that was in the remainder of 884 and the spring and summer of 883. We're now in the fall of 883, and the tireless Ashurnasirpal is hearing the voices of the gods in his head, telling him to never rest and tirelessly bring slaughter to all the universe. Don't stop, don't stop, don't stop, God says kill. So he pops into Nineveh for a bit, for some religious observances, then he heads northeast to smack down some more mountain kingdoms. Now, before carrying the story on, note that he is campaigning non-stop throughout the year. This tells us that he is not calling up his peasant militia for all of these campaigns, or if he is calling them up, it's only in fairly small quantities. The bulk of these armies for these campaigns are his professional soldiers, who are now large enough and well-trained enough that this is all he needs for the sort of wars he's waging. We haven't really seen a professional soldiery that could act without militia support since maybe the Akkadian Empire, and we're not even totally sure that the Akkadian army was actually capable of fielding just their professionals without militia support either. You see, not only does a professional army allow for year-round campaigning, but having more proficient individual fighters often means that fewer actual men are needed, allowing, again, for a vastly reduced logistical footprint. For an army to move with the level of restlessness that Ashurnasirpal is showing in his first year is testament both to the fact that his predecessors have built up significant logistical infrastructure for him to now master, as well as the fact that he's doing an admirable job of winning battle after battle with an army small enough to be effectively supported and fed. I was just calling him a narcissistic psychopath, but whether or not that's actually the case, he is unquestionably an extremely skilled military strategist. He is selecting battles that he can win each time with the army that he's able to muster and transport, and bringing in more peasants to grow his economic base in anticipation of both his major construction projects and his future conquest goals. Anyway, he gets to the mountains of Nippur and Pasate, no idea where they are specifically, but somewhere up in the northeast, and he takes over a small kingdom around there, no idea what kind of people they were, but whoever they were, they got plundered, burnt, taxed, and corvéed, and then a contingent is deported to the heartland. After this, he goes across the Tigris over to the Khabur region and begins to finish out the year with a tribute parade where he visits town after town which his grandfather had pacified to collect gifts. However, his tribute campaign was cut short with the message that a town in the east, Suru, in the Bit-Halupe lands, has rebelled, killing their Assyrian governor and appointing some popular rabble-rouser in his place. Now, it's about wintertime, planting is finished, and so Ashurnasirpal sends messengers to the Assyrian heartland to call out the militia troops. By the time the professional army reaches the core cities, the massed chariots and infantry are assembled, and the different parts of the army all link up smoothly. The Assyrian military machine is clearly at this point a well-oiled and terrifying force to behold. Messengers are already being sent out east along the route of their march to ensure that enough supplies are warehoused to allow the full army to travel at speed without stopping to forage. They did pause on their journey to rest in a few tributary towns where tribute was duly rendered, but these seem to have been quick stopovers on the way to the rebel town of Suru. Upon reaching the town of Suru, Ashurnasirpal tells us that the awe and radiance of the god Ashur came to overwhelm the rebellious men of that town. And whether or not God was involved, seeing the full might of the assembled Assyrian army, which may well have been into the tens or 20,000 strong, many times larger than the professional corps the king had previously been traveling with, well, that seems to have made an impression. In fact, there may well have been more people in this Assyrian army than in the entire land of Suru, depending on how large we reconstruct that kingdom to have been. The leaders of Suru came out to treat with the king, and by treat with, I mean they made a complete submission before Assyria. And so the rabble-rouser was presented to Ashurnasirpal, who threw him in irons until he could be brought back to Nineveh for a public flaying and skin-hanging ceremony. Then the Assyrian army did not enter the town of Suru. Instead, even though it had just surrendered, they assaulted it, as if it had not already surrendered, enslaving the survivors, deeply plundering the palaces and temples alike, carrying off a long list of goods, luxuries, military equipments, male and female slaves, and staples like linen and sheep. The tribute was as numberless as the stars in heaven, all this because they had rebelled, or they had had a leader who rebelled. With the plunder thus handled, and the conquest well in hand following the surrender and then the second surrender, Ashurnasirpal collects all the important people in town, the ones who had surrendered to him the first time, and he begins flaying them alive outside of town. The passage which follows is a bit confusing, or perhaps hard to translate, but it seems that Ashurnasirpal makes all sorts of creative tents and ground coverings with these human skins by attaching them to various stakes and support sticks. With his art project completed, he takes another batch of captives and he castrates them. Then he takes them back as eunuch slaves back to the palace. Now, the heyday of the famous eunuch administrators in Assyria is still well ahead of them, but here we do see that the practice of having eunuch slaves among the royal household is common enough even at this early date to not warrant more than a passing mention. Anyway, having now completed the suppression of the rebellion, Suru gets put under an extremely heavy tax burden, as are all the surrounding towns, and Ashurnasirpal orders the construction of a massive statue of himself to be placed at the gate of the town. Finally, Ashurnasirpal takes the army back to the Assyrian heartland so the peasants can get ready for the harvest while the king celebrates a triumphal parade with some more flaying. Then they rest until the New Year's celebration, which is probably only a few weeks away. Now all that appears to have happened in about a year and a half, which is unbelievably busy and unbelievably well documented. I've actually seen some review articles that mention this particular inscription in passing, and they claim that it covers his entire reign. And this is mistaken, because if you follow the eponymies closely, it actually only covers the years 883 to 878 BCE. This is like 6 years out of 26 that he's going to be king for, but I can hardly fault somebody for looking at all the events described and imagining that they must have been spread out over an entire career. Who could do all that in just a year and a half? And we've still got 5 years to go, something like that. Now, we will get some discussion from this main tablet about later events, but the amount of detail here, just in the early part of his reign, is absolutely staggering. Though it is a lot of repetitive language, and a lot gets lost in all the bombast, As we can see, there's still a lot to be pulled out from these narratives, and they remain one of our best sources for the early workings of the growing Assyrian Empire. Anyway, Ashurnasirpal's second full year sees the year named after him. Now, this is pretty common for a king to take his second full year as his year of eponymy, at least in these early reigns. It seems like receiving a year name typically was intended as a sort of reward or honoring for something that the person had accomplished previously. And merely ascending to the throne didn't quite qualify a king to take a year name at this point, or something like that seems to have been the reasoning. Still, no one can doubt that Ashurnasirpal has, by now, done more than enough to get a year named after him. And so the spring harvest dawns with the king in Nineveh. To celebrate the festival, the governor of a land named Suhu shows up with some tribute. It's interesting that he's framed here as a governor, since the chronicle mentions that Suhu had not actually been a province of Assyria for many generations. This fellow has apparently been acting as an independent king for his whole career, as had his predecessors, for possibly a century or two. However, it seems that Ashurnasirpal sent some sort of letter to Suhu, gently reminding that, as far as he was concerned, they were still governors, and that land was still an Assyrian district. So they should stop playing at being independent and come accept the governorship being offered to them. There was, it seems, either a direct or implied threat that failure to take this fairly generous redefinition of their status would result in a slaughter of the entire noble house of Suhu, probably with some flaying involved. To avoid that, Ili-Ibni shows up on behalf of Suhu, makes all the appropriate gestures, offers an appropriate offering to the god, not to the king, since they are governors of a district, not tributaries of the king. And then just like that, the Assyrian Empire expands once again. However, it seems that a similar letter was sent up the Tigris River to a district in the Armenian highlands near the source of one of the Tigris tributaries. Dam Demusa, which had been established by Shalmaneser back in the Bronze Age, and its ruler Hulaiya, who had claimed descent from the governor who had been appointed way back when, also seems to have forgotten that it had once been, and rightfully still was, an Assyrian province. Rather than send tribute, though, Hulaiha decided to formalize his independence instead. It seems that the gods Asher, Shamash, and Adad were all deeply offended by this act of blasphemy, since of course it was the gods who would be denied their tribute, and they ordered their faithful steward, King Ashurnasirpal, to head up north and revoke that independence. The army was mustered following the harvest, and they all visited the Tigris headwaters, where some kings of Asher had established various statues to their honor, and Ashurnasirpal decided to add his own statue to the collection. He then walked through the land of Izala, who wisely decided to throw in with the Assyrians rather than with the rebels, and then the army arrives at the fortress capital of Kanabu. There is no substantial siege here. Ashurnasirpal's army is large enough to overwhelm the city once they set up outside the walls. The sacking and destruction which follows is famous, even among the famously brutal Assyrian annals. And it's good to get a feel for how the Assyrians are describing these campaigns in their own words. So we're going to close out by reading through the dozen lines describing this campaign in the words of the king's own scribes by the king's own command. Note that this, what I'm about to read to you, it's all one campaign, lasting a few months in a single region, possibly even just a few weeks, intended to clear out what the king views as a pocket of persistent rebellion. I crossed over to Mount Kashiari and approached the city of Kanabu, the fortress city of Hulaia. With the mass of my troops and my fierce battle, I besieged and conquered the city. I felled with the sword 800 of their combat troops. I burnt 3,000 captives from them. I did not leave one of them alive as a hostage. I captured alive Hulaia, their city ruler. I made a pile of their corpses. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. I flayed Hulaia, their city ruler, and draped his skin over the wall of the city Damdamusa. I razed, destroyed, and burnt the city. I conquered the city Mariru, which was in their environs. I felled 50 of their fighting men with the sword, burnt 200 captives from them, and defeated in a battle on the plain 332 troops of the land Nirbu. I brought back prisoners, oxen, and sheep from them. The inhabitants of the land Nirbu, which is at the foot of Mount Uhira, banded together and entered the city Tella, their fortified city. Moving on from the city Kanabu, I'd approach the city Tella. The city wall was well fortified. It was surrounded by three walls. The people put their trust in their strong walls and their large number of troops and did not come down to me. They did not submit to me. In strife and conflict, I besieged and conquered the city. I felled 3,000 of their fighting men with the sword. I carried off prisoners, possessions, oxen, and cattle from them. I burnt many captives from them. I captured many troops alive. From some I cut off their arms and hands. From others I cut off their noses, ears, and extremities. I gouged out the eyes of many troops. I made one pile of the living and one of heads. I hung their heads on trees around the city. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. I razed, destroyed, burnt, and consumed the city. At that time I razed, destroyed, and burnt the cities of the land Nirbu and their strong walls. The campaigning of Ashurnasirpal has only just begun, but we'll leave off here with the question of whether passages like this indicate that the king was personally a straight-up psychopath, as has often been suggested, or if he is ruthlessly pragmatic, operating under the belief that spreading fear will strengthen his empire. If you're on YouTube, I'd be interested in your thoughts on the king down in the comments. If you're on Spotify, I should have a Q&A that you can respond to, but for some reason I can't respond to or see or interact with in any way. And if you're anywhere else, I encourage you to just ponder the line between pragmatism and cruelty in your own mind when you have a chance. And if anyone asks you what you're thinking about, maybe tell them about the Oldest Stories podcast, where we ponder the merits of war crimes in our spare time, because otherwise we'd just be horrified and repulsed by them. But more importantly, I'd love it if you could like and subscribe and whatever else your platform lets you engage with, and then make sure to join us here next time as the psychotic king slaughters his way through even more people, and from the suffering of his victims erects a massive new city out of thin air. Thank you for listening.